please, a deafening round of applause for Alan Saffrick. How's that? There you go.
I feel like I'm being set up by the League of Canadian Canaries. She's tall. This is telling. I believe in the underside of the dog, worship the soft lead pencil, admire the hyena's ability to throat sing, regret turnip's emotional nature, fear black ice in months with ours, celebrate white ants in dark chocolate, praise the intrinsic value of clover, enjoy chatting with sea cucumbers, avoid undertakers who join the circus, dream about the water inside a melon, imagine darkness without the light, remember all the paper kites, collect shadows from the street, respect the absolute authority of puns. About 15 years ago, I moved away from Vancouver. I was born in Vancouver, lived my whole life in the East End in North Burnaby, and I even went to Simon Fraser University. And I moved to a town of 500 in Saskatchewan called Dundurn, Saskatchewan. It's about 40K south of Saskatoon on the road to, on the highway to Regina. If anybody ever passes that way, you're welcome to come to my house for a cappuccino. I live on 211 First Street in the Jacoby House, which was built in 1906. Just ask anybody at the Racetech Gas where it is, and you're welcome to come by. Sometimes I think about I live in the middle of nowhere, I guess you could say. It's kind of interesting because it's a very good place to write. There's a lot of writing in Saskatchewan. It's almost a kind of a national pursuit there. I've been coming to Toronto for a long time. I don't even want to tell you how many years, but almost 40 years. And I have a real interesting connection with this neighborhood. In fact, I got seriously mugged on Gray Street once, ended up hospitalized, and I used to stay on houses almost in this neighborhood, and I'm really addicted to the old college and Clinton kind of neighborhood, you know, Batondos. I go to the Diplomatico for old time's sake to have a cappuccino. And while I was sitting there this afternoon, I was thinking about Toronto, and I was thinking about how does this book relate to Toronto in a way, and almost everything I write seems to have Toronto in it somewhere. And I was thinking about Robert Billings. The Robert in this poem that I'm going to read is Robert Billings. I don't know if anybody remembers him, but Robert Billings was worth remembering. You might find a couple of his books in the library. He lived really hard for poetry. And he came up in the Niagara Falls one day with, only reason they knew it was him was he wrote his name in his shoe in indelible ink. And I really felt partly responsible for Robert Billings because I used to just hate his guts, right? And give him a hard time whenever I saw him. He thought he was a total asshole, right? And I really felt I contributed to the end of him for a long time. But now I really know that's not true. Maybe you can guess some of the other people in this poem. Voices. They argue in the back of my mind when I'm trying to think about more important matters like how to pay the bills or edit the last stanza to sop sentimentality overflowing into the next unwritten page. Sharing a few memories not good enough. They want to stay up all night and recall controversial incidents and anecdotes ad infinitum. Speculating about complex relationships, offering regrets whenever they think it's suitable to do so in the face of so much evidence about the way nostalgia colors the glass. None of them think they got enough attention, and they are restless to live again in my inner thoughts because I'm the only one left remembering. I find a text to occupy my insomnia, send them packing into the night. Stanley still thinks women worth dying for. Frank wants his overdue royalties with interest. Dorsey is anxious to get laid after all these years. Milton proclaims the Isle of Tola a mensch. Earl doubts his fame will last another decade. Anne fusses over another pot of literary soup. Robin pines for a slug of Jameson's Irish whiskey. Kenneth recounts every detail in the summer of 1928. Gwen speculates about the fate of her Egyptian cats. Cheap Al, proud of all the drinks he caged. John begs me to leave the TV on all night. Robert mumbling about why he killed himself.
So for starters, I think like a couple of your poems, you sort of preface by saying you live in Saskatchewan in the middle of nowhere. Is that pretty much sum up your community?
Well, it's a community of 500 people.
And that's kind of a small town in Canada, right? It's a rural area. It's 35 miles from Saskatoon, 35K from Saskatoon. So I'd say it's pretty isolated right. in some contexts, not really in terms of there's schools and people and, you know, lots of farmers in the rural area around and not too far to the next town, about 14K to the next town. And then there's a lake called Blackstrap Lake where I live. It's a big man-made lake, and it has two village resorts on it that are... have a couple hundred people in each of those villages, so but it's a fairly rural place. Yeah,
well, whether you're talking about sort of rural people or whether you're talking about a bunch of poets you met, Milton Acorn included, your poems seem to be populated with a lot of characters, and one of them is just a kind of a list of names and all their, you know, sort of the attributes of these people that you recall.
Well, you know what, I was a brat, and I started out, and I really met a lot of the older poets along the way. I totally knew everybody, really. And so at a really young age, I knew Earl Burney and Milton and F.R. Scott and Dorothy Livesay. I actually worked a lot with her, and John Glasgow. And I just knew them all, and so I was also working in publishing. And they all had this incredible kind of thing about an insatiable desire to get out there and do their thing. And I didn't realize what they were all infected with, which was poetry is kind of a small world. And even then, I guess most of them had worked in obscurity through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And then there was this thing in the 60s where they all come. There was a joint revolution in universities, and Catlett came in, and they all suddenly became known entities. And they were, and their books started getting known, and they started getting known, and they were all frantically going from here to there all the time, promoting themselves, right? And the thing that I never really realized at the time, was only something I realized when I got older, was all of them felt neglected. And so sometimes when I think, I'm a sort of lifetime addict for writing. And I think, well, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about poetry and writing, and I spend a lot of nights doing it, and sometimes they come into my mind, right? And I think, holy cow, you know, Earl Burney was right when he was a really known entity. Everybody knew him. He used to travel around. His books were selling. McClellan Stewart used to get rid of tons of his books. They probably sold, you know, editions of 5,000 or something. I mean, I'm sure Purdy must have sold, you know, some of his books must have sold 10,000 copies or whatever. I mean, there was people selling a lot of books. Margaret Atwood's poetry sold a lot of books. And Dorothy Livesay sold a lot. Some of those old-timers sold a lot. Well, I don't think Atwood's an old-timer, but I mean, some of those really older ones sold a lot of books suddenly. And then they were still near the ends of their lives saying, oh, nobody's going to remember me, you know, I'm going to be in it. And it's true. Who remembers Earl Burney anymore? Whoever talks about him? There's nothing at the universities anymore. I mean, everything's changed socially. So in a way, I think about them. I think, and it comes back to me in my mind at night when I'm sitting alone thinking, I can hear their voices saying, you know. So it's kind of satire, okay? But it was just one poem. It's only one poem like that. But it made me think that, for me, like, writing is a lifetime pursuit. I do it because I can't help but do it. I'm not interested in anything else about it. I try to promote it a bit, but, you know, I choose to live in a really isolated place. I don't really care about what the future much, you know. I'm only doing it because I can't stop doing it, and because I like to do it, and because it's sort of it's a way of fulfilling ideas that I have about spirituality and religion, and it fills that for me. Writing poetry is very much like being a poet, much like being a monk. You know, and you can find your spiritual world and your salvation there in writing. And reading and writing are really that spiritual salvation for me. That's where I find and I thought most of those people did that too. But they kind of got carried away, some of them, you know, because they got a small taste of success. And the universities, people were doing master's degrees on them, PhDs. The Canada Council used to have a thing where they could have secretaries when they got old. They helped with their papers. Some of them started getting a lot of writer's grants and stuff. And they did pretty well, right? And then when I looked back about it now, nobody's doing very well compared to then. And how would they feel now, right, if they were around? So that's all I was meaning. I think it's an interesting thing about writing and how everything changes every decade or every half a decade. It all changes. New people come up. Where did all the old ones go?
So I used to stay at Peter Milroy's house. It used to be about 4 in from Grayson College. And my book is dedicated to John Newlove, a wonderful Canadian poet. I don't know if you know his work. I'm sure everyone knows his work. And he was born in Saskatchewan. He was born in Kamsack, Saskatchewan. And one day I ended up breaking down. My car broke down just outside a town called Yellowgrass. And that was where John Newlove went from grade 1 to grade 3. And everywhere I went in Saskatchewan, there are connections with him. And I knew him pretty well for a long time and used to stay with him on Grace Street, too, when he lived on Grace Street. So the poem about Grace Street for John Newlove. Three nights of snow whisper through blue attic windows. One skinny light bulb hangs in the shadow of its own elongated, slightly twisted chicken neck cord. Beacon for angels, undressed night moves into a warm room. Above formal wrought iron fences and Italian cement lions, a solitary light waits the coming of the insipid brown moth. Truth needs inquisitors like summer needs Sundays. In the midnight garden of atrocious wallpaper, a solitary light gives off the sun. The dangling man dangles in his underwear in a rooftop street, afraid this might be all there is to heaven. A white sandblasted room, a dump truck filled with rosary beads, one thin coat passing a prayer from the cold through a single blue attic window, snowfall of souls, bag of chicken feathers drifting in from Gray Street. All about dying in bed. I was writing another epic poem concerning my obsession about dying in bed when the undertaker rang the doorbell. Roy, my buddy from grade 9 and the old neighborhood, has come by to tell me he's taken over the family business. Last time I saw Roy, we were punting from midfield on third down. The dog became quite upset with Roy for fingering his rubber toy revolver without permission. Pow, pow, he kept saying under his breath. I saw it in the gentle blueness that ran through his smoky eyes, the excitement of another day in the embalming room. Let's say a geranium pops up on an old woman's hat in the market, and somebody tries to cut her head off to make a flower arrangement. It's 4:45. There's no more stinky cheese. The city is paralyzed by traffic jams. I feel liberated and strangely lightheaded knowing that Roy is nearby. I want to call him up and say, get her a really nice coffin with William Morris wallpaper. Take cuttings from the hat for the gardening of her soul. This is the kind of thing that happens to me. I live in the middle of nowhere, and I lived by a lake, and this is the kind of thing that happens to me in the summer. Maybe it happens to you too, I don't know. Visitors. They come down the path waving like old friends. I've never seen them before in my life. You are Joseph, the man shouts enthusiastically before he embraces me, crying on my shoulder, rubbing his flinty cheek against my face. You must be Matilda, the blocky woman insists, taking your red hands in her fat fingers. We look in vain in the phone book, question the oldest living resident in the area. He couldn't remember anybody with those names. It's not us, I said, feeling guilty about the truth. We've come so far, she sighed, with her back to the lake. Just after dessert, I put another log on the fire. There's also the matter of the rented car. I could hear the clock chiming in his shiny head. Are you sure you aren't Joseph and Matilda? I assured him I was sure, but it didn't inspire his confidence, writing down everything in a little black book. She reclining on the rug with her legs rubbing together like a praying mantis, sun setting softly in the trees.